This call is being recorded.
Shango, Mojuba.
That people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
If we must die, let it not be like hogs hunted and penned in an inglorious spot, while round us bark the mad and hungry dogs making their mock at our cursed lot. If we must die, oh, let us nobly die, so that our precious blood may not be shed in vain. Then even the monsters we defy shall be constrained to honor us though dead. O kinsmen, we must meet the common foe. Though far outnumbered, let us show brave, and for their thousand blows deal one death blow. What though before us lies the open grave? Like men, we'll face the murderous, cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying, but fighting back.
Hotep, my brothers and sisters, good afternoon, good evening to all of you. You are listening to the Black Reality Think Tank here on Tuesday evening. My name is William Rogers, and I am your host for the evening. We are here every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. We are broadcasting on the timeforanawakening.com network. And I am so very happy to be with you this afternoon. We are here at our studios in Lithonia, Georgia. Nice rainy day today, basically all day, but it's good. Cleans the air and makes it easier to sleep at night. So anyway, we're very thankful, though, for you for joining us this afternoon and coming with us in this very dynamic discussion. We have some wonderful guests that are going to be joining us in just a few minutes. They're all on the air now, and we are going to be talking about the inevitability of a race war in America, or is that just fake news? Is that just imagination? We want to look at the reality of that. This is the Black Reality Think Tank, and we are here to look at issues and ideas from a realistic perspective. And so we've got a wonderful panel this afternoon that I'm going to be introducing you to in just a few minutes that will talk about that. The Black Reality Think Tank here on the Time for Awakening Network is produced by the Sankofa Historical Society, as well, and it is sponsored by the Motherland Media Network, which also has a program on this network called African Perspectives. And we're going to be talking about that in just a few minutes. But right now, don't want to prolong our conversation too much. I'm going to do what we always do every week, is that we have a profile of our ancestors that we like to do. We have an ancestral profile. I've often quoted the great Fannie Lou Hamer says, "We must always praise the bridges that brought us over." And so it is out of that spirit that we do each week an ancestral profile. So this week I am going to present the spirit and energy of a great ancestor that we really don't talk about a lot, but we need to. And his name is Fred Hampton. At around 5 o'clock a.m. on December the 4th, 1969, a little over 48 years ago, almost close to 50 years ago, Black Panther Party member Fred Hampton, who was 21 years of age, and another brother by the name of Mark Clark, who was 22 years of age, was shot to death by the Chicago Police Department. 14 police officers raided Fred Hampton's apartment, which was a known Illinois Black Panther Party facility in Chicago's west side. And the gunfire that occurred that evening lasted 7 minutes. And at the conclusion of that, Hampton and Clark were shot dead while sleeping. Never forget that almost 48 years ago to this day, the FBI and the Chicago Police Department has what's now been known conspired to murder Fred Hampton in his apartment because they were afraid he was creating a multiracial political coalition to challenge those in power. According to most press at the time, this was a catastrophic event. At that particular time, authorities claimed that the Black Panthers opened fire on the police while they were serving a search warrant for weapons and have maintained that they were justified in the return fire. The Chicago Tribune reported this in one of their stories. But evidence from that night has shown that the FBI, the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, and the Chicago Police Department worked together to assassinate Fred Hampton. In the months that followed, a federal investigation showed that only one shot was fired by the Panthers. The police, on the other hand, fired 82 to 99 shots. Cook County State Attorney Edward Hanoran was indicted for the raid, but was cleared along with 13 other law enforcement agents, according to the Chicago Tribune. The incident worsened an already contentious relationship between the Panthers and the police, resulting in 8 gun battles nationally within the following 2 years, which left 3 cops and 5 more Panthers dead. Fred Hampton said, we always say in the Black Panther Party that they can do anything they want to us. We might not be back. I might be in jail, he said. I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you will remember, I said, with the last words on my lips, that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am proletariat. I am the people. Fred Hampton was born on August 30th, 1948, in what was called Summit, Illinois. And he grew up in Maywood, which are both suburbs in Chicago. His parents had moved north from Louisiana, and both worked at the Argo Starch Company. As a youth, Hampton was gifted, both in the classroom and on the athletic field, and strongly desired to play center field with the New York Yankees. He graduated from Proviso East College in nearby River Grove, Illinois, where he majored in pre-law. He planned to become more familiar with the legal system, to use it as a defense against police. He and fellow Black Panthers would follow police, watching out for the police brutality, and use the knowledge of law as a defense. He also became active in the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which is the NAACP, and he assumed leadership of their youth council of the organization's West Suburban Branch. In his capacity as an NAACP youth organizer, Hampton began to demonstrate the natural leadership abilities from a community of 27,000 people. He was able to muster a youth group and 500 members strong. He worked to get more and better recreational facilities established in the neighborhoods and to improve educational resources for Maywood's impoverished Black community. Through his involvement with the NAACP, Hampton hoped to achieve social change through nonviolent activism and community organizing. About the same time that Hampton was successfully organizing young African Americans for the NAACP, the Black Panther Party started rising to national prominence. Hampton was quickly attracted to the Black Panther's approach, which was based on a 10-point program. It integrated Black self-determination on the basis of Maoism. Hampton joined the party and relocated to downtown Chicago. And in November of 1968, he joined the party Nascent Illinois chapter, which was founded by Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee organizer Bob Brown in the late 1967. Over the next year, Hampton and his associates made a number of significant achievements in Chicago. Perhaps his most important accomplishment was his brokering of a non-aggression pact between Chicago's most powerful street gangs, emphasizing that racial and ethnic conflict between gangs would only keep its members entrenched in poverty. Hampton strove to forge a cross-conscious, multiracial alliance between the Black Panther Party, the Young Patriots Organization, and the Young Lords, under the leadership of Jose Chacha Jimenez. Fred Hampton met the Young Lords in the Chicago Lincoln Park neighborhood the day after the Young Lords were in the news after they had occupied a police community workshop meeting held in the second floor of the Chicago 18th District Police Station. Later, the Rainbow Coalition was joined nationwide by the students of a Democratic Society, SDS it was called, the Brown Berets, and the Red Guard Party. In May of 1969, Hampton called a press conference to announce that this Rainbow Coalition had formed. It was a phrase coined by Hampton and made popular over the years by Reverend Jesse Jackson. But it was Fred Hampton that coined that name, the Rainbow Coalition. And eventually he appropriated the name in forming his own unrelated coalition, meaning Jesse Jackson, called the Rainbow Push Corporation. Hampton's ongoing skills, substantial oratorical gifts, and personal charisma allowed him to rise quickly in the ranks of the Black Panther Party. Once he became leader of the Chicago chapter, He organized weekly rallies, worked closely with the Black Panther Party's local People's Clinic, taught political education classes every morning at 6 a.m., and he launched a project for community supervision of the police departments in that area. Hampton was also instrumental in the Black Panther Party's free breakfast program. When Brown left the party with Stokely Carmichael in the FBI-tormented SNCC Panther split, Hampton assumed championship of the Illinois State Black Panther Party, automatically making him a national Black Panther Party deputy chairman. As the Panther leadership across the country began to sort of decline by the impact of the FBI's COINTEL program, Hampton's prominence in the national hierarchy increased rapidly and dramatically. Eventually, Hampton was in line to be appointed to the party's Central Committee Chief of Staff. He would have achieved this position had it not been killed by the Chicago Police Department on the morning of December the 4th, 1969. Fred Hampton. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to get started with our discussion today. We have definitely warranted by a discussion such as this, and we are just happy to have the members that we have asked to join us. We've asked my very good and dear friend, Dr. Bruce Bridges, who is the author of a book called I'm sorry, Bruce, I'm stumbling. I read so hard, I stumbled there. But he wrote a book called Recapturing the African Mind. And he is a professor of religious studies at the Apex School of Theology in Durham, North Carolina. And he has done a magnificent job of helping us here at the Black Reality Think Tank, not only with just his own presentation, but with the solicitation of guests and others. And I really do appreciate him and appreciate the work he's done. He is the former owner of a wonderful bookstore in Durham, North Carolina, about three blocks down the street from North Carolina Central University, called The No Books. I really wish it was still there. If it was still there, I might not be sitting here talking with you now. I might be there where I could hang out in that bookstore. It was truly an archive of history, Black history. But he is with us here, and he's a part of our show. And then one of my classmates from Hillside High School in Durham, North Carolina, Brother Herbie White, also a fellow Brooklynite, New Yorker, who was around doing all of this stuff that we are getting ready to talk about, around the formation of the Black Party, around the whole Harlem initiative that was going on during the Civil Rights Movement. So Mr. White is here. And then also Ms. Benisa Ayard, she is here, a very good and dear friend and supporter of the Black Reality Think Tank. She's part of our support staff, and she does a lot to help us in pulling together the program. She is also a mentor to our younger producer. She is here, and she's here to provide us with a perspective of the mother of things and what the mother womb system feels about some of the things that we are talking about. And so we really, really appreciate her. And then I have another brother that he doesn't even know that I was made him a part of the panel, because I was trying to get to him earlier today and couldn't do it. Brother Otis Griffin from Newport News. I need Brother Griffin on this discussion. So Brother Griffin, I'm getting ready to turn your mic on in a few minutes. And I apologize for not warning you, but I know that you understand very clearly what we are getting ready to talk about. So I have those four, and then I have some other friends who are obviously online. They are holding. I know my brother Timothy from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, is online, part of the Black Panther Party. I'm sorry, part of the Nation of Islam in the Philadelphia Mosque. And so he's here, and he's going to talk about a few things as well. So I'm going to turn on the four microphones, and I'm going to just briefly introduce to our audience our discussion, and then I want to really launch right on in to what we're saying. Okay, let's start off like this, brothers and sisters. I am in preparing for this topic tonight, and the topic is a race war in America inevitable, or is that fake news? And the reason that I added that particular part to it is because a lot of people argue, and in some cases it may be valid, that a lot of the things that we are seeing are being staged in order to make a statement. As you know, recently the whole Russian initiative that they were using the media and social media to intimidate the U.S. to try to create disruption and confusion, to try to disrupt the election and some of those things. So they were posting pictures and stuff, particularly involving African Americans, that basically were just set up and staged. I know there was one photo that was circulating for a while, and it was about something, the sign that said, "We hate NIGGRES, go back to Africa." Very clearly, that was, I remember the documentation of that, and actually in the photograph, you could determine that that wasn't done in America, that that was done somewhere else. But nevertheless, I mean, those things were out there. But the question is, as a community, and I mean as an African-American community, and as thinkers, we have an obligation to make each other aware if we know something of things that are going on. We have an obligation to sort of corral ourselves and stop letting things like this happen. We have got to stop our children from dying. That just cannot happen. And we can't just sit by idly and let that continue. We have to do something. And so the question is, what is it that you must do? And how is it that we must organize ourselves in preparation to do it? As I did some research in preparation for this discussion, there was one article that was in the Huffington Post, and they indicated that over 300 black people have been killed by police in 2016 and for various things. And then there was a timeline that was put in the USA Today of a list of the assassinations of black people in America, like, for instance, in 24. And there are some names that we kind of haven't remembered in a while. We knew when it happened. Names like Ezell Ford out of Los Angeles, whose 25-year-old brother was shot in 2014. Akai Gurley, this was around the same time that Tamir Rice was shot. Romaine Brisbane, Jermaine Reed. And then in 2015, we had Ortego Howard, Jeremy Lett, LaVal Hall, Thomas Allen, Charlie Lindu, K.O. Yang. March 6th, Vin Zant. N. Van Zant was killed, 37 years old, in Colorado. Tony Robertson, Anthony Hill, Bobby Gross, Brandon Jones, Eric Harris, Walter Scott, Frank Shepard, William Chapman, David Felix, Brandon Glenn, Chris Jackson, Spencer McCain, Victor LaRosa, and I can just keep going on, but I want to hear you talk. All of these are African men, African-American men that have been killed by a police officer. And then let's don't forget the poster boy of white terror, Dylann Roof, who went into that church and killed those black people without any remorse. So the question is, what are we looking at? Is this coincidence stuff? Or is this just things that would happen? Is this based on modern times? And just how do we view this as a community? And then the ultimate question is, what are we going to do about it? So let me start with my very good friend, Dr. Bridges. Dr. Bridges, launch into that for us.
All right. Bill, thanks for inviting me. And just briefly, I do want to just let you know, as you let everybody on the panel and people who are tuned into your program know about people who support you and who call in and who are on the panel tonight. But I want to appreciate you for just giving that background on Brother Fred Hampton. And I knew about Fred Hampton, have been knowing about him even before his death. And I was a personal friend of Brother Bob Brown, who actually was responsible for setting up that Panther party organization in Chicago, because because Bob Brown was a follower of Kwame Ture or Stokely Carmichael. And for more than one time, I had Bob Brown to speak at my store in Durham, North Carolina, when he was a member of the All African People's Revolutionary Party under the leadership of Stokely Carmichael. And even before Bob Brown spoke at my store, I used to go to Washington, D.C. to African Liberation Day, ALD, as they used to call it, which was held in Malcolm X Park. And Bob Brown would always be there, and he would introduce Brother Stokely Carmichael. So I appreciate you giving that history. And one thing, too, about Bob Brown and Stokely Carmichael and Fred Hansen is the fact that leadership was being arranged and leadership was being taught, because leadership has to be taught to a certain extent. There are some people who are just natural leaders, but to have mentors like Bob Brown and Stokely Carmichael before the young Fred Hampton actually helped him to become the man that he became. So I want to just thank you for kind of reminding me. I knew it, but I hadn't thought about it in a long time. And this is why history has to be kept out before us in terms of letting people know what happened and what caused people to become kings. So I just wanted to thank you for even spotlighting Fred Hampton, and you spotlight Fred Hampton at a time which is time because African men such as the brother that was killed in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and that you mentioned, I mentioned that one in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, because that was rather recent. But yes, so it's nothing. The point is, I want to make about what you're saying is that none of this is nothing new. It's nothing new at all. It has all been going on. And this is why, as John Henry Clark said before your program began, history is like a clock. It's like a compass and lets you know what time it is. And when I think about what's going on today, I hear discussions on the radio, and they've even pulled black people into the conversation, like the sister legislator out in California. I can't even think of her name, talking about Hispanic children being taken away from their parents. I think about the fact that, as Minister Farrakhan said, you talk about what's going on with other people, but look at what happens to us. With all due respect to any parents being taken away from their children, we get pulled into what's going on today because we don't know and understand the history. Look at what happened to us in slavery and how our families were broken and were fractured and were destroyed and cut up and just torn apart by the slave master. And we don't even think about that. But when white people put out before us what's going on today with this Hispanic situation, we weigh in on it, but we don't really, in other words, we begin to feel for other people, and we have not felt for ourselves because we don't know our history and our culture. And if we understand our history, we wouldn't have the same feeling for what's going on today as compared to what went on yesterday. So history, as you gave it out with Fred Hampton, is very important. His athletic skills and what he was doing, and the fact that he was not just anybody off the street. He was playing ball. He was also a good student, but then he became a revolutionary. You see, because oftentimes we begin to think, well, why is Jameel El-Amin or why is H.R.A.P. Brown in the situation that he's in? Or why was Huey shot down? Why did Angela Davis do what she did? Why did Kathleen Cleaver do what she did? Why did Erica Huggins do what she did? We don't understand that these people were the cream of the crop of black America, were young students who were thinking and using their critical thinking and their analytical abilities to look at the situation and to dissect it and to synthesize and to analyze what's going on. And then they begin to see the rottenness in the whole system of America, and not just to see the rottenness in the system of America, but began to do something about what they saw. And when they began to do it, we look at them and we wonder why they did it. But the reason we won is because we are not on the level that they're on, but we think that something's wrong with them because they stand up like Colin Kaepernick did, or because they stand up like Raouf Mahmoud did many years before Colin Kaepernick, and would not and disdained the Star Spangled Banner. These are people who are thinking people, and we wonder what's wrong with them. But the question should be asked is, why are you not standing up against the system, and why are you not questioning things, as opposed to you wondering why the ones who do it do what they do?
There you go. Amen. I like that. Ooh, I like that. Yes, indeed. Thank you. Let me go. First of all, let me say to our audience, for those who are listening via the Internet, if you would like to participate in this conversation, we welcome you to do that. Our call-in number is area code 215-490-9832. I repeat, area code 215-490-9832. Let me go to Brother Griffin, Otis Griffin, and ask him a minute. Brother Griffin, there has been a well-known theory among anthropologists and sociologists and so forth that a lot of times, because America is a war nation and it's a war power, we send the young boys out into the battlefields to kill. And very recently, the crisis in the Middle East was known as the Middle East. I hate calling it because that's not what it is. But in the in that area of Afghanistan and Iraq and so forth, there are young men over there who are just destined to kill, and they have to kill because there's a fight, and if they don't, they'll be killed. So it creates this blood hunger, and so a lot of times they're over there 2, 3 years, 4 years. And all they're doing is killing, 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 killing. And then when they come home, you can't cut that off. And I'm asking you because, you know, you're an ex-military man. And you can't cut that off. And so historically, that's been a well-known fact. Because if you remember, when the Civil War occurred, right after the Civil War, young men were coming home from that battle and they were becoming straight-up killers. So a lot of your cowboys, your Billy the Kid, your Wild Bill Hickok, all of those were former military people who were trained to kill in battle. And so what I've read is that a lot of police departments and municipalities have a tendency to want to hire those soldiers coming right out of the service. Because, first of all, they're not afraid. They understand battle. And they got blood on their tongues. So I want to ask you, is that a valid kind of analysis as we look at the, what's considered to be a lot of time bloodthirsty police officers who don't hesitate to shoot? Are these ex-soldiers from Afghanistan? And you got to remember, the Afghanistan people that they're fighting look like black folks. They look like us anyway. So is that some kind of a mental flashback? And I'm not asking you to assess it psychologically, but I'm saying, is that a concern that you think, being an ex-military man, with what we are seeing out here with these police officers?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers.
Yes.
I'm surprised that you bring that up, because it's been an ongoing theme with myself and some of my fellow military people who served for 20, 22 years. We say often that had we known in the 70s what we know now, we would never have served, because we understand that we were nothing but puppets for imperialism.
Right.
And I'll change it a little bit further to tell you, when you talk about what's going on with these police departments, it's not just that they're hiring ex-vets. It's just most people don't understand that since 9/11 and Chertoff became the head of Homeland Security, most of the major police departments in America have been trained by the Israeli IDF forces.
Right.
This is, so that means we've gone, since 2001, or 2003 when they created Homeland Security and all of this. So we're looking at 15 years of this nation's majority of the police forces being militarized. And then the bad part, coming from my perspective, is we have 8 years of that was a president with a black face, and he unleashed those people on our communities. And it's not just black communities, but we suffer the brunt of it.
Okay. Yeah, because I remember during the 70s, the police departments were hiring Vietnam vets quickly. I just wanted to indicate that someone in the, I have the microphones open, and I think someone is doing something right at your mic, and it definitely can be picked up. So if you could be mindful of that, I appreciate it. I wanted to leave your mics on so that we'd be ready to talk. But there's something someone is doing there, manipulating something, and you can hear it bouncing up and down. So please be mindful of that. And during the Vietnam War, they were hiring Vietnam vets. And I remember in New York, because I took the policeman's exam as well. On the exam, I made a 92. But that would normally put you right in the top of the list. But I was like number 460 on that list. And the reason why is because the Vietnam vets were getting a 10-point advantage just by being a vet. And if you were in the war, you got another 5 points. So if they made an 80, they would be pushed way ahead of anybody else who might have had a raw score of 90 or 90 so forth. And obviously encouraging police officers, former vets to apply as police officers. And so I think that there's something there in the logic of all of that, you know, and you're right. And that's why I kind of thought about it. And a lot of them are trigger happy. Now, am I right to assume that that does happen when a soldier comes home from a war battlefield, that he's still trigger happy, that that's still there?
Well, I think so. I don't really have a lot of evidence on that.
Okay.
But we've been realizing that a lot of the police officers that are using this excessive force, what they're not saying to you, some of these people have PTSD. Some of them are on medications. A lot of times these police departments are having troubles with steroid use and won't tell the public. So there's a whole lot of factors involved in that. But primarily, understanding police were created as slave catchers. We have to understand exactly what police do.
Right.
Police were actually formed to keep black people in line. And I'm 60. I just had my 65th birthday Sunday.
All right.
And I'm telling
Happy
you,
birthday.
I do not see much difference in a police department now, even with black faces, because most of the ones with black faces assume that any perpetrator they run into is guilty. And they treat them as such. That's why they're not reluctant to take their lives, because they perform summary execution. There is nothing that tells me having more black officers will save us, because it is a mindset.
Right. I agree. You're right. You know, I was so horrified. I watched the video yesterday on the news of the releasing of that police shooting in Minnesota, when that brother was running and he was hollering back to the police officer, "Please don't shoot me. Don't shoot me. Don't shoot me." And they just fired off and just pop, 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 you know, and just took him down like he was a dog. And that's a mindset that's definitely something very strange, right? Let me go
Dr.
over.
Dr. Rogers.
Yeah, go ahead. Uh-huh.
Before you move on, I want to add one thing.
Yeah.
I hope before you finish tonight that we get to touch on the value of using LeBron James in Akron, Ohio, to open a school, the symbolism of that, because in my mind, it goes right along with what happened with the Black Panther. I don't understand why our people keep falling for symbolism, when in reality, if you follow the destruction of public schools over the last three decades, and I know personally, because I wasn't a father until 40 years old, so I watched other people raise children.
Right.
And I watched what happened with No Child Left Behind, moving on into Common Core.
Right.
Anybody that can see that as a positive without critiquing the fact that it's setting people up so that private, public-private partnerships will end up usurping the responsibility that every state has in its constitution to educate its citizens. People are not understanding what's being played on them right now.
Right. Okay, yeah, well, that's the way. We definitely want to come back to that. We don't doubt about that. I agree with you. Let me go over here to Brother Herbie White, who is from Durham, North Carolina as well, my former classmate at Hillside High School. So glad to have him on. I really appreciate him. I'm glad Dr. Bridges found him for me. And we had some wonderful dialogue. Brother White, what is Dylann Roof's problem? Now, he's not a police officer. What was his deal?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers.
Good evening, Robert.
And everyone else on the panel. Hotep, thank you for inviting me to your show.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Dylann Roof is just one individual in a group of psychopathic people that are identified as white.
Okay.
If we have 23 chromosomes, like they say, and white people, 22 of them is violent and one is dormant.
Okay.
You know,
yeah,
this is something that's been going on for 500 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, a simple evidence of that is Charles Manson.
Oh, yeah.
Charles Manson took young white girls who had never killed an insect. And without anybody doing anything to harm them, turned them into murderers. They had no problem with it. And they was able to just go out and just do it. That's because of that psychopathic gene in them.
Okay.
They just can't help it. Not only other people, everything, the environment, nature, animals. I mean, kill 60 million bison. You know, just kill.
Yeah, kill.
It's something that's in them or something that's missing in them that makes this kind of thing possible. And to do it and not have any compunction. Not bother them in any way, and in a lot of cases are considered as heroes.
Right.
Dylann Roof, if all Dylann Roof had to do was join the police department, he would have been a hero.
Right.
You
that's
know,
not funny, you but say, you're, I right, you're right.
Somebody
about
in
that.
Church had a gun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it would have been all right.
And you know, it's so much of things behind that, like you said. I mean, a lot of times I'm watching stuff like that, but I'm watching the behind-the-scenes stuff. That when they first arrested him, they didn't put handcuffs on him. They just walked him into the police car. He never cracked a smile. They never said anything harsh. Now, this man just killed a whole bunch of people. He obviously is a mass murderer. He is, he's done the same thing the guy did in Las Vegas or whatever. Only difference is this was all black folk. They never responded to him that way. Never. It was almost...
When they took him, he was in his car.
Right.
So they couldn't see what he had in his hands, what was in the car.
Nothing.
I mean, so many black people have been murdered because they said they were reaching for something or they thought they had a gun or they thought they had this. Well, you know that this person just killed a lot of people, and he's in a car. You can't see whether he got a gun. Well, you know he got a gun, but you felt confident enough to take him without firing a shot.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He's not the only one. That guy out there in Colorado, that movie, he was out there in the parking lot with right. automatic weapons. They took him alive.
Okay.
So mm-hmm. this is nothing new to them. The reason that they didn't shoot him is because they felt the kinship. That's why I took him and got him a hamburger. They figured all that shooting and made him hungry.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Brother White. Appreciate that. Let's go over to my sister, Brother Sister Jan from Greensboro, North Carolina. Sister Yan, you're a representative of the mother of our community. You're the symbol for that. So you speak with the womb. You speak in the tongue of the womb. How long are we going to keep letting people kill our babies?
Repeat that, please. How long what?
How long are we going to keep on letting people kill our children, our babies?
Well, I hope we stop it tonight.
Okay.
Okay, I hope we stop it tonight. I hope we begin to organize. Not I hope, I don't use that word, but we need to begin to organize, stop agonizing, or organize as we agonize, strategize, and do something about this, because it's not okay. I watched, before I go there, let me say this. So I do believe that whites want a race war. They have been talking about it and working toward it for the past 500 years, well, after slavery. You know, they need to get rid of us. And they've been doing that, just that, ever since. During Jim Crow, those that were doing the lynching, you know, the hanging and the cutting off of body parts and castrating and all the other horrible things they were doing, you know, pushing a plug into a person's body and pulling out a plug of flesh, quivering flesh. They found 50 ways to torture us. Those were your sheriffs. Those were your lawyers. They were labeled the prominent people participated directly in organizing and carrying out lynching. They weren't just roving bands of, you know, crazy white, you know, white boys. So all the male population were involved in the act of lynching. And everybody sees the pictures of the smiling white little girls, you know, watching and just enjoying watching someone, a human being getting tortured to death. So I'm with the brother that just said, you know, there is a psychopathic gene there. They're doing the same thing in Australia. You know, the same thing in Africa. There's just a murderous, a homicidal maniac gene that these people have, and we need to face that truth. Another piece that I want to point out is that I was watching a video, the KKK and the skinheads and the rest of those homicidal maniacs, and they had a huge convention. And the leader, I can't remember his name, but he gave them very specific instructions. He said, skinheads, grow your hair back, you know, KKK, take the sheets off and all that stuff that you're doing, all that exterior stuff, and you put on suits and ties, and you get in the police department, and you get in politics.
Wow.
He gave them instructions, and that's exactly what they did.
Right.
The other thing is that there's way before Trayvon Martin, the Communist Party, they would print out an annual report of how many people that had been killed by police. The majority of them were black, and I don't know how far back this goes, but at least 20 years ago, you know, I had a thick book of how many blacks were killed by police. So this has been going on. We've been, I would say, under attack, not at war, because when you're in the war, you fight back.
Right.
But we've been under attack for the past hundred, you know, several hundred years, and As a woman, it breaks my heart. I would like to see our men stand up and fight back. But you mentioned the word realistic. Realistically, we can't afford to lose our men if we don't have an actual army. So we need to develop some strategies.
All right. Yes. Okay. And we're going to come back to just some of the points that you brought out. Let me say to our audience that is online right now, if you would like to voice your opinion, the phone number here, area code 215-490-9832. And I repeat, 215-490-9832. And there are some of you that are on the switchboard now also who were not part of the regular panel, but you may be desiring to say something. So I am going to call on you right now. If you do want to say something, you can. If not, then you can just ignore my request, and I'll know that you're just on to listen. So therefore, we have a caller. I don't have a number. It's just said that the name is Russell. So, Russell, do you desire to have a comment or question, my brother? Okay, I guess not. So you just want to listen. We have a caller that's area code 336 589. Just a second. Now, let me. 336-589. Okay, so they're just.
Good evening, oh, brother. How are you?
Okay, great.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I hear you very well.
Okay, thank you. I really appreciate this forum. Well, I'd like to just chime in on the question of the evening, which is what you just asked Sister Beniswa. How long do we continue to let this happen? Moreover, what can we do about it? I'd like to defer and speak directly to the men at this point, because much of what we see in our community that's happening within the community is on us, in my opinion.
Okay.
From the young brothers on the corners with the pants down to the shooting in our community, all these different challenges that we have, it is up to the black man to take a stand, to establish a set of norms and systems that would help develop these brothers into the men that we became. We had norms and systems and examples in the community. To speak specifically to the question of the killing of our children, no civilized man, no civilized people would allow another people to kill their children and their women.
That's
like
true.
We're doing.
That's true.
It is a sign of weakness, and it's better that we not be here. Huh. However, for me, my take is that separation is the only key. How much longer do we want to have our children killed? How much longer do we go through the court systems where the police officer is white, the judge is white, prosecutor is white, defense attorney is white? Even if they're not white in color, they suffer from that Caucasian mentality that does not bode well for us. And so separation, indeed, is a major answer, probably the only answer. We've gone through every aspect, every remedy, every idea. We've waded in the water. We counted the grains of sand on the beach. We've done everything we could possibly do to bring parity. And when we see what we saw in Oakland, California, where the brothers' daughters, one was killed and the other one was just hurt and slashed by the knife by this Caucasian, it gave my heart joy to know that these brothers got together and went and found this guy, is my understanding. But he's in prison. And the judges and the police chiefs and their shriners, they're Mason, they know the law.
Mm-hmm.
They know the law. 5-1-9-2-4-2. I remember Minister Farrakhan making a statement when one of the sisters was killed. And he said, "We'll fire your raggedy A wherever you are, and we will kill you." And he called on the judges and said, "You know the law of the crime. You know the law. You study this in your Masonic lodges." And so it is a sign of weakness when we don't handle our business better.
Okay.
And it's better that we not be here. So one of the solutions, a major solution, is we need to begin wherever we are. And I'm calling on the men. I would love them to call me. We need to set up our own patrols in our community, a set of norms, some training, men are training for the men and the boys.
Mm-hmm.
We need to get this started right away because it is an assault. I sit as a president of a black police association. And you are right. Many of these that serve mm-hmm. have the same illness. So you have power to enforce the law, but when we see that the young man is killed at the hand of a Caucasian, you stand there quiet, knowing that it was done illegally, and it's a sign of your impotence.
Right.
You're impotent. Mm. Hmm? And so what man stands by? Actually, thank God it wasn't my daughter's, because I'd be calling for his death in the streets. That's right. Just me now. I'm not telling you all. I'm just saying that's my spirit. Take out mine, take out yours. We start thinking like that. People start thinking twice before they mess with you.
Mm-hmm.
See? And so I would really ask the brothers that hear my voice tonight that we unite. Feel free, I don't know if I can give my number, you feel free to share it out, but I really want to get us together and form pockets around this country. We don't have to be vigilantes, but we have the right to self-defense.
Okay.
You know? And the other part is we have to have our own. We can't, brothers, you can't live on somebody else's property, talking about. So we have to establish our own neighborhood. The Black okay. Panther had it right. I mean, at least we you know, the Jews say, lest we forget.
Yeah, they
we
did.
We got all the history.
Right.
Oh, I'm sorry?
No, I'm saying you're right. They did have it right. They had it right. The Black Panthers, you were indicating.
They had it right. And so we need to learn from that now. And you know, so there's going to be some challenges. There's going to be some lives lost, health we're losing now. In fact, the rate of death in our community surpassed that of some nations. Do the research.
Right.
Why are we the number one leaders of a prison industrial complex? We're the workers at $75 and $1.25 a day. And so that's now a business in North Carolina, New York, California, all around the country.
Right.
Hmm? And so, brothers, that's the biggest game going. And then you couple that with this ignorance of this religious thing, you know, Jesus being white, the assault on the deity, if you will. We got a lot of fights. We fight on many fronts.
Yes.
Just heard about the CDC announcing and admitting that it put autism in African-American boys. Brother Wesley Muhammad just gave us empirical proof, undisputed, that the marijuana has been chemicalized and weaponized against us for years.
Yep, sure has.
Making our boys feminine and the sisters masculine. So, brothers, it's time now. Otherwise, just fold it up and forget about it. We don't have these discussions anymore. But these discussions, though, because there's many of us out here who will hear this and make the call to unite and take our community back.
Right.
That must happen. It's not an if or a wish. We must do that. Thank you, brother.
Yeah, and I will declare that I will support you and your effort to pull together. I'll use this platform. I'm willing to do that. I'll talk to Sister Ayan, and so I can reach out to you on a personal meeting and to help, you know, to make the call, if you would like to do that, into an organized structure. Definitely willing to do that. And anybody else, you know, on the line here now, we can do as well. Right? Because the time is, the time has been for a long time. But I think that this is just getting really ridiculous. And so we've got to respond. I want to go over to my brother Timothy, who is a member of the mosque out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Brother Timothy, I've shared with you quite often. I have a love for the work and the vision of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and obviously for the work of Minister Farrakhan and some of the things he's done. But Brother Timothy, I got to ask you. I remember back when Brother Khalid Muhammad was around. When these things took place, he responded immediately to a lot of the kinds of things that were going on in the country. I remember that whole situation out of somewhere down in Florida, where he and a group of men went out there with the guns as a form of protection, and that they were attempting to do that. I recall the Nation of Islam situation that happened in Tuskegee, Alabama, when they went down there as a source of protection to when the white knights of the Ku Klux Klan were having some kind of rally or something, and they came actually face to face, and the white knights of the Ku Klux Klan backed up to the nation. Could you share with us, please, a little bit? And I know you are not a spokesman for the per se for the Nation of Islam, but how does Minister Farrakhan view what's going on now, not only just as an incident, but in terms of a response? And I know that at some point we can get some brothers from the nation to come on and talk, who basically would be a spokesperson for that. We've had Brother Wesley Muhammad on. We talked to him about some of those kinds of things. But what would you say, Brother Timothy, in relationship to how the minister might look and how he's teaching you all in the mosque in order to respond to some of these things that you see?
Well, thank you, Dr. Rogers, for holding me in such high esteem. You referred to me first from the Black Panther Party, and sir, I honestly would like to claim that. But it's okay. I'm a member of the Nation of Islam, and by the time I became a member of the Nation of Islam, conscious first of it before joining it, the nation, what we know of the Black Panther Party with Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale was on his way out.
Right.
So as a teenager, I was influenced by the nation, and in my early 20s, I became a member. But I'm going to tell you some history about the Ku Klux Klan and Elijah Muhammad. In the Message of the Black Man, there is a quote that Elijah Muhammad talked about, J.B. Stoner. And J.B. Stoner was one of the imperial wizards of the Ku Klux Klan, I believe, in Georgia, the Georgia branch. Dr. Bridges would tell you that Jeremiah Shabazz out of Temple Number 12 in Philadelphia had a assignment to go down in Georgia, and he walked into a Ku Klux Klan meeting, and he became cordial with them. And like you and I have talked about, the nation that Marcus Garvey was building and the Ku Klux Klan were very pragmatic. And they like Garvey because they like his stance on separation. Well, they happen to like Elijah Muhammad. And J.B. Stoner said the same thing that that young lady said on the phone, that he told Elijah Muhammad that our men in sheets one day will be running for political office, will be in all forms of administration in America, and we're coming at you not with white sheets on, but suits. She was correct. Now, you can look it up in the Message of the Black Man, and I'm going to say this to you, that in studying the white man, nobody in America knew the white man like Elijah Muhammad. Now, if he would have said that the white man was diabolical, he might have went down in history as one of the greatest men there was in the United States. But because he used the word devil, and he died using that word, they couldn't claim he's so great. Instead, when they waited for the separation with him and Malcolm, they would give it to Malcolm instead of Elijah Muhammad. But I'm going to say something in the nation that a lot of us who read really, really read, and people like J.B. Stoner, I looked at some of his works. Also, Charles Manson. If you ever read the book Helter Skelter, his race war, what he thought of whites and blacks fighting and him taking over the world with his group, he said this, that the white man could destroy the world, give it to the black man, and he could come out a whole looking like Jesus and take it back. So these things that they had in their minds on white supremacy have not left. Give example. If you've been looking at the television recently, they've been displaying this plastic gun that you'll be able to get from the design on the internet. They have that in your mind subliminally, that you can get this plastic gun. It can either be a revolver or automatic weapon. And they are gearing up for this race war. And the thing is, how much are we prepared? Remember, Du Bois said, the problem of the 20th century is colorism. that's not going well. Are we prepared to deal with the situation that's coming down the pipe? Now, with Trump out of office, it's not going anywhere. And so here's the thing. We look at the Black Panther Party. They were socialists.
Right.
We look at Nation of Islam. They were building a nation. Under Booker T's roof, socialism and nationalism can exist with race first. Remember that, we're race first. So how do we prepare ourselves for the race war? Now, I wouldn't be mindful to say that even Farrakhan, if he was on this call, he would talk about J.B. Stoner. If you heard me mention J.B. Stoner, he could probably tell you more about J.B. Stoner than me. But Elijah Muhammad understood the European well, how to deal with him economically, socially, and politically, and how to coexist with this beast. Now, all these people, I always say this, that were before us, who gave us a blueprint, Noble Girali, Elijah Muhammad, Marcus Garvey, Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, for some reason, we're not following that formula.
Okay.
But we need to go back to it. And if necessary, arm yourself. Pam said, arm yourself or harm yourself.
Okay. Okay. All right. So before...
Can I comment at all? Is it time or is it possible I could comment?
Go right ahead. No problem.
Let me, I too served under the leadership of the Minister, Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan.
Yes, sir.
And let me say this, that the brothers in the nation, as you know, don't carry weapons. Because we believe, and it's, I want to be very clear that we talk about will there be a race, it has already started. We're behind the curve. It's been going on for a long time. You understand? It is not just happening. I think when we first opened up, the brother talked about who P. Newton and the Black Panther Party and Snick and all the others. So this thing has been going on a long time. And now, with the advent of all the new weaponry and science, and we talked to a group recently about, you know, your phone, and you'd be able to put your finger on your phone and it cuts on, or pointed at your face and telephone the call. In real time right now, the database that they have with Martin Luther King's information, you can pull it up and talk to Martin Luther King in your phone and ask him questions. The database, the computer system will answer you. We are so far behind. You understand? And so the only true, you know, will it be a race war? Will it be a race war? It's already a race war. It's here. We proceed not. And so what we have to do, in my opinion, is do what the minister said. Do for self. Establish your own schools, banks, hospitals, everything we did during the, and then be prepared to defend it.
Right.
That's where you go. Even if it's separation, let's just say 8 or 9 states, minimally rich with outlet to the sea.
Okay.
Why did he say that? Because he knew that they was coming. So I just wanted to chime in and just say that it's very important that we recognize that the race war is not coming. It's here. It's already on. And they're attacking us wholesale, as they always have, and we have not responded accordingly. What if it was Jews? What would happen?
I like that.
Thank
I
you.
I like that. Okay. Let me do this. We are you're listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. We are here every Tuesday evening from 8 p.m. to 10, we are here on the platform of timeforanawakening.com, which is a part of the blacktalkradionetwork.com. There are other dynamic programs on this network. You have African Perspectives that airs every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, that program is hosted by Brother Osiemi Adelabu. It's called African Perspectives. And then we have Time for an Awakening, which is hosted by Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. It airs every Friday evening from 8 to 10 and every Sunday from 7 to 10 here on timeforanawakening.com. So we encourage you to please take a look at the programs. You could also go to the website www.timeforanawakening.com and look at a list of the other programs as well as the archive. All of our programs are archived. This program will be archived and available for listening to as well. So we just wanted to let you know and be mindful of that. I'm going to go over here to the brother or sister, maybe a sister, a brother, not sure, but Newark, New Jersey, area code 973-704. Good afternoon, sir or ma'am. Do you desire to ask a question or make a comment? Okay, I just on to listen. That's all right.
No, thank you.
Yes?
No, thank you. I'm just listening.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay. What I'd like to do is we have one Philadelphia call here, 267-902. Would you like to listen, make a comment, or just listen? Okay, so you just listen as well. That's fine. You can all continue to please to do that. That's also. Let me go to Dr. Bridges. Dr. Bridges, I got to ask you a question. You wrote a book called Recapturing the African Mind. Okay, let me paint a picture for you right quick, real quick picture. On the streets of America, you got a lot of young African-American brothers walking around with AK-47s, 9mm, 38s, 20, all kind of caliber weapons. And if I gave you a pound of weed and told you to pay me back when you sell it and you didn't pay me, you could very well lose your life. So I may come back in a drive-by and wipe you out and anybody standing near you. But on the same token, you got a man like George Zimmerman that is still walking the streets of America. And he's walking around talking junk, being proud, and saying everything that he can say about black folk in any kind of way he wants to say it, as well as others. Can you please tell me, is this a part of what your book wants to know about recapturing the African mind? What would make a young man kill another black man because he owed him for a pound of weed versus him being able to respond to someone that is shooting up your community and killing other people? What is the difference in that whole idea? Explain that to us from a historical perspective. Dr. Bridges, you there? Dr. Bridges? Okay. So I guess he's not there. Brother White, you wanna take a shot at that for me? I'm not sure where Bruce is.
Okay, Dr. Rogers, there's a couple of points I want to make.
Okay.
We have been focusing on police brutality and the police murdering our young black men and women too. But the problem is the police are acting on behalf of the white community at large. They're just one part of the operation. They're just carrying out the murders and whatnot on behalf of all of the rest of the white people who sanction this kind of stuff and who want this to go on. If you look at the military, only a small percentage of people in the military are on the battlefield. The rest of the people in the military are in a support position to support them and to keep them, but they're all working for the same thing. So if we just focus on the police department, that's only 1% of the problem and whatnot. And the war is going on. It's a war for containment and control. They don't want to get rid of us. They need us. They need our brilliance. They need our understanding, and they need our essence. They don't want to kill us off. They want to control us. It's always been about control and containment to get from us what they need from us to do the things that they need for us to do that they can't do.
Okay.
And when you spoke about George Zimmerman, why is he walking the streets? What would be the advantage of doing away with George Zimmerman if you didn't do away with the six people on the jury to let him go?
Right.
Okay.
Just as much of a problem.
Okay. I like that.
Just as much of a problem.
I like that. Okay. Maybe Dr. Bridges, did I have your mic? Dr. Bridges, are you there?
I'm right here.
Okay, good. Okay, I know what happened. You got a lot of background noise.
Been here all the time. I was here when you first called. I've been here.
Okay, you got background noise there. That's one of the reasons why I probably get silenced.
Yeah. No noise in my background at all.
Yeah, something is rumbling. But go ahead, answer that question.
All right, a little better now?
Okay, that's good. That's perfect.
Okay. Yeah, I moved on the cell phone. Yeah, but the point I want to make, first of all, one time many years ago, I had Brother Jamil Alameen, H-Rap Brown, who is now incarcerated, who I've been working with and committed to try to get him a retrial on my radio program I had many years ago. And he got into a verbal confrontation with another brother. And I'm going to say something that he said to the brother who called into my radio program. He said that everything that we need to do and that we are going to put into action in terms of a strategy, I'm saying the same thing. We cannot discuss it all on the radio or on the internet. So I just wanted to make that point. But okay. I also want to make the point that, well, you know, when you asked me earlier, when you didn't know I was on, about the brother on the corner, one thing that I have noticed, and that is, can you hear me okay?
Oh, yeah, I hear you. Real good.
Yeah, one thing I have noticed, and that is that when black people, for the most part, talk about doing something to somebody for something they've done, it's always black on black. And one of the brothers, the brother from Philadelphia and also the brother from Greensboro, made a point. He talked about Minister Farrakhan. And I heard Minister Farrakhan say one time, which is true, self-hatred has been bred into the black man and black woman. So much so that we're in our own communities, in our own environment, in our own little bottle. And when something happens, we strike out or attack each other as opposed to attacking the person who is a root of what we are attacking each other for. For example, you got the East Coast gang and the West Coast gangs. You got the Bloods, you got the Crips. In Chicago, you had the Young Lords, and you had Larry Hoover and the gangster disciples, but mostly all of this was black on black. So when we talk about recapturing the African mind and beginning to do something about our situation, first of all, we as a people have to understand how to identify who the real enemy is. The real enemy is not the brother who may not have paid you for the bag of herb, or the brother who may not have paid you for the bag of rock. He's not the real enemy, but we need to look at the root of his disdain for you and his hatred for you and the reason he did not pay you. And when we look at it, we'll see that there's a hand, as I don't love to say, there's a hand, the hand of the sneaking devil, that's behind all of this, that you don't constantly be really fighting each other, Nation of Islam, against or to be more specific, the Black Panther Party against the organization that Melania Karanga had, the cultural organization out in California, fighting each other when we are not the problem. And the counterintelligence program organization of J. Edgar Hoover and white people in this country have sent letters to Eldridge Cleaver and letters to Kathleen Cleaver to talk about what Eldridge was doing outside their marriage, to get them fighting against each other, or to send a letter to Huey about what Bobby is doing and to get them. We have to begin to understand how to define who the enemy is and not to believe everything that comes before us, so that we will not attack each other, because that is a tactic of the white supremacists of the counterintelligence program. And H.R.A.P. Brown talked to me about it, in which I can't go into right now. Like I said, I understand where we are, and the the system that we're using to get this information out. But talk to me a long time about how J. Edgar Hoover and the COINTELPRO was able to pit different people against each other in the black community and have us fighting each other. And it's easier for me to get to you than for the white man to get to you, because we run in the same circles. We live in the same neighborhood. We live on the same block. So it's easy for crabs in a barrel to begin to fight each other and not recognizing the enemy behind all of it. But when we get our minds back, then we'll know who the real enemy is and understand that we're really not the enemy to each other. Look at Tookie Williams out in California, who was allowed to die by that cracker, Schwarzenegger. Look at the whole situation. Bloods against Crips, East Coast gang, West Coast gang, Biggie against Tupac, and all this that's going on. But the real enemy is standing back laughing at you and me, you see. So that's what we have to, first of all, we have to be taught and have to learn how to get our minds back and begin to identify the real enemy and look at the enemy for who he is, and to recognize that your brother ain't your real enemy, but the enemy is not within you and your community, but the enemy is outside of you and your community.
Okay, that's powerful. Let me ask you this then, Dr. Bridges. I understand, I do recognize the sensitivity of talking about this over the open air, that you can't do that. COINTELPRO and some of those other programs should have taught us definitely that you can't talk about all of these things. You know, we're being watched and bugged and so forth.
And this is why, not to cut you off either, Dr. Rogers, this is why what the brother from Greensboro said is so powerful. That is, you know, we need to have a sit down and get together with some brothers. And I think Sister Anya, Sister Benice, why I made the statement too. Hey, we need our own force. Right. You see, and nobody has to know who's who and who's doing what, and keep your mouth closed and do what needs to be done. That's the only way it can be done. And it's the same way that America knows right now what's going on in North Korea, and they say North Korea is building weapons. And the reason America knows that is because America has intelligence or another mind outside of America that's over in Korea and knows everything that's going on. But North Korea may know it, may not know it, but may not know where it's coming from. But that's the same way that we as people have to operate. Everything can't be broadcast on the bulletin board.
Exactly. I agree with you. Okay, let me ask Sister Yan. Sister Yan, you're a very strong community activist. You've been doing a lot of work in the Greensboro area, North Carolina area. How do you pull together a coalition like that to talk about the real deal? And I'll just leave it at that. Not to talk about teddy bear memorials and doing all some of those kind of things. How do you do that? Pull together. I'm not saying what you do. I'm just saying, how do you pull together people like that?
Well, I'll share very openly one of the things that we did that was successful for a little while. And none of this is new. I called together the leaders in Greensboro, the conscious leaders, and it was a call to action. Not a call to talk about what's wrong and what we need to do, but a call to action.
Okay.
This was after one of our young brothers had gotten murdered and, you know, was all over the media. And so everybody showed up pretty much. We worded the call in very strong terms. And so we had people come out that people hadn't seen for like 10 years and 15 years, and it was pretty amazing. And I talked about what we're facing. This is why we need to meet, we need to organize, and we need to put solutions in action. And at that meeting, we asked people to stand up and commit to doing particular things. So, of course, we had your usual economics, you know, someone in charge of economics and education, and, you know, the same old structures that we talk about, similar to what Minister Farrakhan was asking with the LLC. And we had great attendance, excitement, and it lasted for about four meetings. And then we started to fizzle out. And what I want to say is that I see that our people in the conscious community, we know what we need to do, and we will show up. But the stick-to-witness, that commitment, begins to fizzle out. And we need to address those particular things, why we are failing, why we're not succeeding, why we're not able to connect with our youth, you know, in a way to bring them into the struggle and teach them what to do. Because another thing I want to say is that I talk to so many young people, they want to fight, but they literally don't know how.
Okay.
And they say, you all haven't taught us. So we need to bridge that generation gap. And but anyway, so that's one of the methods that we use. And it had the potential to be successful. But again, it was nothing different from what Panthers and, you know, Nation of Islam is doing. We just have a problem with sticking to it. The other thing I want to say is that we got to talk about internalized depression, because as we're having these conversations, you know, the fear is very evident. We have to admit that a lot of us are afraid of this system. This system has terrorized us, and we don't need to be ashamed of it either. This system has very successfully terrorized Black folks to the point where we know that if we stand up, you know, somebody's going to get killed. And it's human nature. We don't want to die. And so we need to admit that, you know, there is some fear, because if we weren't afraid, we'd be out doing something. And the other thing is that we can do one thing. We can get our people to understand that we're actually under attack and in a war, you know, because we like to focus on, well, some segment of our community, we like to focus on, oh, but we made these strides and we've gained all these, you know, we have all these politicians and we have billionaires and this and that. And they want to focus on the things, the so-called accomplishments, and they can't see the war.
Right.
So we got to help our people to see, no, we're actually still in a war, and take them out of denial, because as long as the people are in denial about the fact that something really horrible is happening to them, they're not going to stand up. They're not going to organize. They're not going to strategize. So we do. We still have to get the minds. We still have to deal with the traumatized. You know, there are ways to do that. But we got to use a holistic approach. But we got to do something. One more quick thing, God. I want to say this earlier. I watched the Trayvon Martin documentary. Did anybody else on the panel see that last night?
No.
Yeah, I did. Go right ahead, brother. Go ahead, sister. What's your point?
I watched the Trayvon Martin documentary last night on BET.
Right.
First relevant thing they've had, and I don't know when. But it was sobering. It was sobering. It showed the whole process of, you know, of the baby getting killed, and right. Zimmerman just cocky, and, you know, just how he was arrested. That whole thing played out, and the devastation of the parents. And, you know, as a woman, I went into such grief and sadness, and I listened to the brothers asking for justice. You know, why would you ask for justice from a system who's shown you that they have no interest in justice?
Right.
You know, why we keep begging for help from people who are trying to destroy you? So we have to change these mindsets. And we need to, I don't like to keep saying we need to, but we do have to work on our mindset and grieve some of this stuff that's happening in front of us, because it can be paralyzing.
Right.
If we don't grieve this stuff and deal with the anger that we're carrying, it will paralyze us, and we'll just be talking and talking and never do anything.
Okay. All right. Brother White, let me ask you a direct to the point question. Do you see a race war coming, or is there, and obviously not taking consideration, a race war means two sides fighting each other, not homicide, not just plain murder, because if the other side's not fighting back, then that's homicide. So do you see a war?
Like I said, what's taking part on behalf of white people is a war in a sense, but it's a war for control of an asset.
Okay.
So they're killing us on one hand and nurturing us on the other hand. And the part of us that's being nurtured is working against the part of us that's resisting. So that's why you have the millionaires and the people that's doing well, and saying that the reason that other people are in the position they're in is because they're not trying hard enough. But they need our spirit and our intelligence and our spirit to keep this country going, to keep this world going.
Okay.
So it's not a war to wipe us out. They could easily wipe us out.
Right.
I mean, they could poison us. And, you know, they got, you know, they're making some stuff down there at Fort Detrick, Maryland, and whatnot, ethno-specific chemicals that could wipe us out in one day and whatnot. But
that's
they, but that's not what they, that's not what they need. They need us. People don't believe that, but they need us. I mean, when Europeans first came to this country, the Moors and Africans had been in Spain for 700 years. So when they found a country that needed to be developed, they knew where the skill set was to do that. So they went right back to Africa. They wasn't looking for laborers. They didn't get us our labor. They got us our brains because we were able to build something that they weren't able to do. And they've been living off of what we create ever since then. We fought in every war and played a significant role in the winning of their wars. They do not want to get rid of us. We excel at everything that we do. They know that. They know our spirit. They're taking our body parts to replace their body parts because they know ours work better. So it's not, they're not looking for a war, you on this side, I'm on the other side, and we shooting it out until nobody's left.
Okay.
That's not going to work for them.
Great.
If they kill us, they kill themselves.
Okay. Let me ask the brother from Greensboro, 336-589. What do you think? You see a race war coming?
Well, brother, I believe while all of this has, there's no wrong answer, but I tend to lean toward the belief that they don't need us anymore. You know, we live in the valley of the shadow of death, man, every day. That they have at one time needed us to build this and do that, but today they no longer need you. That's why, you know, they gave the farmers bad seeds to grow. That's why they gave autism to the black brothers, the children, and now admit it at the CDC. That's why Pat Robertson wrote a book, The Death of the West. He recognized that when one or two hours are born, none of them, they have a zero birth rate. They're having babies in the back of cars. You know, and so they understand the numbers game. Just Google Pat Robertson's book. Just Google Bill Gates, population control. He says it openly. You understand? So this thing is about control. This thing is about getting rid of what people have do a dead weight to them. And so our fight is multifaceted. But the biggest one, in my opinion, is, or one of the biggest ones, is we're fighting for the hearts and minds of our people.
Okay.
And we're standing on the top of a mountain saying, look, come this way. Five of the sinners are saying it, the Nation of Islam is saying it, the preachers are saying it. And so there's no synergy, you know, and so that's what they didn't want. That's why they had to kill Martin and Malcolm, because we were creating, they were that person that has a lion paw, that person who can call out and create a fellowship and bring the different thoughts together and find synergy. That's our challenge. And when we do that, and see, another proof is that just Google this stuff. The U.S. District Attorney, Mr. Sessions, put out what's called the Black Identity Extremist.
Jeff Sessions program.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
What is that? So what's the Black Identity Extremist? What's the white one? Now, we clearly know what the white one is.
Right.
So we saw one brother who was a test case, and we let him go off to prison and jail because he had self-pride. That's all it was. He didn't go out and kill anybody with a sheet on his head. You understand? So this is the game, you all. This is the game. It is about
the hearts and minds of our people. They no longer need you. They no longer need us. In fact, Mr. Gates said, you know, this whole continent over in Africa, and they're getting the brunt of this stuff. These third world nations, they're really dumping crap into their water and everything else, testing on it and doing that here. So either we stand up, you know, I mean, really take a stand. I've worked with Dennis Muhammad, Captain Dennis, who has what we call the name of it is the Peacekeepers. And we've gone around from Greensboro, different states, all around the country, getting these young boys and men together. They're now patrolling their neighborhood, doing the food deserts, and supporting. And you barbers, if you're on the line, you barbershops and beauty salons, you are the new leaders. You know who killed Pookie. You know who did this and that in the community. And if the Chinese man does something wrong in the community, you put his picture up in your place and say, don't go there. Guess what? The people are going to follow you. So now, as a new leader, barber and beauty salon owner, your place now, I'm pushing this in Greensboro, your place must now be a polling place. We can begin to really get the masses. They're not going downtown to vote. And that's just one component. I know people say, well, you know, voting is no good. Yeah, but we have the numbers. And the reality is our people really are not going to the poll because we don't see no help in that. Well, but if we get those stations as polling places all over the country, man, in our neighborhoods, we will dictate who go in. We just found out, you guys Google this, another fight we're on, Greensboro, the city of Greensboro, spends $300 million a year on goods and services. They have what's called the minority business enterprise section that should ensure that minority businesses get at least 35% of that money spent, of that $300
million.
Okay. We get less than 2%. A recent disparity study said we get less than 2%, and this has been going on for years.
Yes.
And so now we're fighting that fight because it's our tax dollars. We put into that budget also. And so, listen, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, this fight is real. It's very multifaceted. And we can't afford to, as the brother said, allow them to infiltrate and pit me against you and you against others. We are one people.
Okay.
One destiny, one aim. No fighting, no more.
Okay.
We agree that we disagree on approaches, and we move forward.
All right.
You supporting me, and me supporting you. Thank you, man.
Okay. Thank you for that. That's excellent. One of the things that we definitely recognize, and that's what we see in this Stand Your Ground law, and some of these black identity extremist concept. This is put together by the Justice Department, FBI, Jeff Sessions, and all of that stuff, that they will create. The system will create laws and see to it that they are implemented that gives them the right hand to do that. Search and seizure, all of that kind of stuff is a part of that. And so that's an ongoing battle. And we have to obviously be prepared to deal with that. So that's something that faces us all the time. And it's got so many. And I think one of the key points, and that's one of the things I think Dr. Bridges was saying, is we've got to educate about these. We've got to tell our young folks about some of these things that are staring at them, which gives the police the right to do certain things to them according to their laws. It's not the right of humanity, but according to their laws, it gives them the right to do some ugly stuff. But before we go on, we still got about 30 minutes left to go. I want to make sure that I have honed in to this whole thing about this these killings and the possibilities of these race wars, because very clearly, I think the question I asked Mr. White about Dylann Roof, we know that that's not over, and there's going to be more of that, and that's not police, that's some of these outside groups, and one of the things that the Timothy McVeighs, Dylann Roofs, and some of these real other crazy kinds of folk in Mississippi, Alabama, and really it's not even the South anymore. Minnesota, Colorado, Nevada and all of these areas of America that you've got these extremist kind of ideas and people that are waiting for the opportunity to make a move. I want to make sure that we have talked about very clearly the preparation for dealing with that in our community. And as I said, I do recognize, I'm very clear about that, that there's only certain things that you can talk about and how you do that. But at the same time, there's some public verbiage that we have to begin to talk about in terms of educating our children. And one of the things I've proposed a thousand times in this program is the idea of the community schools, the Saturday schools, because in venues like that, you can talk about some private issues, and you can talk about them in a way that you can prepare young folk to deal with that. But I want to go to Ms. Ayan one more time, because again, she is symbolic of the of our womb, the womb of the community, the mother of the community. She's the one that cries the hardest. And I say, when I say she, I mean the black woman. There's never a more horrifying sound than to hear the screaming of a mother whose child has just been shot on the street. That's, and I know we all have heard that. So there's a pain that I don't even want to address about that in that way in terms of the pain. But the deal is, how do we set up something other than your meetings and so forth? There's got to be something that we do. So when an incident like that happens and all the community comes together, the first thing you do is a candlelight vigil. The next thing you do is teddy bears on a pole. There has got to be another response. So, Sister Ayan, what should that response look like, other than the candlelight vigil and the teddy bears on the poles?
Well,
I would say similar to what I said earlier. We have to strategize, because I personally, I'd be happy to get a weapon and just go do some damage. You know, I'd be happy to do that. And I do have a problem with Zimmerman running around. You know, he needs to be made mindful of. That's how I feel. From my experience, Doc, we don't strategize enough. We'll get together and we'll talk about what's wrong and what we need to do.
Okay.
But we don't strategize. You know,
explain strategize. Explain that so we can.
Okay. So let's say someone gets you know, killed by whomever here. Then the community, instead of coming together, like you said, doing the teddy bears or going to have a prayer vigil or whatnot, put out a call for some people that want to, for some men that want to go through some type of training, you know, to learn how to defend our community.
Okay.
And women. Think about the things that you want and that we want and we need, and make it happen. Because again, we do a lot of talking, but executing is a whole different, and I've experienced this so much, I wish I could stress to you all, I've tried several ways to organize our people here in Greensboro, and it just fizzles out. And so, I could use some, you know, some help in this area, actually, because I just think it's really a psychological problem that we've developed, and that's trauma. You know, we know what to do. We know how to fight back, but we turn on each other. So yeah, we can strategize. We can, you know, like you said, the Saturday schools, we can immediately go to a church and say, you know what, we give you a lot of money every Sunday. We need your classrooms. We need your, you know, your building, your facility, and we want to start meeting here, you know. And we also want you to start teaching liberation theology instead of pacifying your congregation, you know. So one of the things we can do is change ourselves. Look at what we're doing and do something better. Look at our traditions, use our traditions, because we can't change a psychopathic European, but we can change ourselves. Another thing we can do, I do want to say this.
Okay.
Black folk tend to be hooked into becoming a Christian or a Muslim. You know, we like to identify with particular religions. We have an African spiritual system that can empower us to fight back more effectively. But we've been made so afraid of our Africanness, and we've rejected our Africanness. And so even forming alliances with the brothers and sisters from the motherland, they're open. We're not open, and not as open as we need to be, put it that way. But they're open. They're saying, let's fight together. We have the same ancestors.
Right.
You're in America or Brazil or Haiti, whatever. We're in Africa. You know, we need to push the Pan-African movement forward. But we have something called Vodun, and we have other African spiritual systems where there is a way to fight back. It is not an aggressive system.
Okay.
You can't do any harm, but you can fight back if somebody's attacking you.
All right. Now you're talking.
And we got to teach our people that. I would suggest that everybody watch 1804.
Okay.
Google Baina Bello and how she teaches about the Haitian Revolution and how our people united, used African spirituality, and fought back and won. But if you're afraid of who you are, if you don't like who you are as an African, you're not going to embrace a power that you have that's just lying dormant.
Okay.
So that is one thing we can actually do. You know, it takes time. There's no, I can't think of an immediate thing that we can
do besides go and do some damage somewhere. I just want
to
put a little fire in this talking. And that's you did that just now. That's excellent. That's exactly what I was looking to do. I know we can't say certain things. I know you can't come up with a solution tonight, and that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to just give those who are out here who are in the community fighting every day, you know, that thing that you need. Dr. Bridges.
Well, can I say this real quick, Doc?
Okay.
Can I say this real quick? I want to repeat. Vodun, Ifa, Santeria, these are spiritual. This is what you can do to wage spiritual warfare. But if you're stuck in Christianity, which pacifies you, then you won't be free to access that. I want to repeat that.
Okay, beautiful. Dr. Bridges, you're a historian on the panel. Let me ask you something. Let's go back to history. Dr. John Henry Clark said it's the clock that tells us our place. Two incidents I'm thinking about. When the police beat the brother up in New York, during the Malcolm era, whose name was Hinton, and Malcolm called those brothers together from the nation, and they went down to that precinct, and they faced that precinct and demanded that, first of all, he be given medical attention and that he be considered and looked at. That's one incident I want to bring your attention to, and that was a more recent.
That's a good one, too.
Yes, it's a very good one. And then there's one in the early history that was used by the Quilombo fighters out of Brazil.
Right.
And they had a slogan, and it said, "If the reason that you are a slave is because you're afraid to die." So I want you to address those two concepts from history as it relates to us forming an ideology in modern times. Talk about that a little bit.
All right. And first of all, I want to commend Sister Benicewa on what she said in terms of which, and she kind of did what you asked me to do, but I'll go a little further and be a little specific in terms of situation in Brazil and the situation with Malcolm in New York with Brother Hinton Johnson, which was his name, as a matter of fact, and a lot of people don't know it. He really was from, Brother Johnson Hinton, I think it is,
right.
But he's from Durham, North Carolina. Let me mention that. I won't go into all that right now, but I do have some very specific information about that incident. And but Sister Benice Ward did mention the Haitian Revolution.
Right.
And she talked about what Boukman and what Toussaint Louverture and Dessalines did and how they fought against the French and defeated the French by using Vodun and the African spirituality. And there was no Islam being used there, at least not by that name, and no Christianity being used there, at least by, not by that name. And if there was any Christianity being used there, the European gods that the French had given the African community there in Santo Domingo, as it was called, it has been transformed into African gods and goddesses and used to supplant the French and to destroy their government there. So that's one example. And you mentioned the other example of Malcolm. And as you mentioned Malcolm, and we go back to history, that reminds me a clear example of what Brother Kwame Ture always said to us whenever we met or whenever he was talking. He would say that what we need, and he would say it just like this, is organization. Organization. You have to be organized. Right. And that's what Malcolm portrayed quite vividly, in that the hundreds of black men who stood outside that police department with Malcolm in charge and Malcolm in the leadership, and they moved to his every command, white people will tremble at our feet if we become organized. And we can go back and look historically at what happened in the bus boycott in Alabama with Dr. King. That's organization. Right. And so, and as Sister Beniswa said, that's what we need to do now. And she said, too, which is a good point, we'll work for a while, then we fizzle out. But you must have organization. And that's one reason that out of all the organizations that we have in this country, the Nation of Islam, with the right leadership, not saying that Minister Farrakhan is not the right leadership, but with a leadership that's very activist-oriented and doing the kinds of things that Malcolm did, it would make all the difference in the world. You see, and so I wanted to mention that in terms of the Malcolm situation. And of course, right. And then you mentioned down in Brazil, it was the same situation in Brazil. And also, since you mentioned Brazil, brother, Simon Bolivar, for which the country of Bolivia in South America gets his name. And he's oftentimes called the George Washington of South America, because he liberated most of the, not of course not alone, but he led the leadership to liberate most of the countries in South America from the Spanish hold. And he was able to do it only because, and if you check your history, you'll find this out. This is a little known fact I'm about to give up here. He was Simon Bolivar, who was, as they call, Creole from aristocracy in South America, was able to liberate most of the countries of South America, Bolivia, Colombia, Venezuela, Argentina, Peru, most of the Ecuador, Uruguay, Paraguay. The reason that most of those countries were liberated is because Simon Bolivar went to his brothers across the water in Haiti and got Haitian soldiers or Haitian followers of Toussaint L'Ouverture and brought them back, and they helped to defeat the Spanish in South America. Right. It's organization. Okay. And it's also Pan-Africanism. He didn't just depend on black people in South America. He saw that there were some Africans on a little small island named Santo Domingo, and he went there, recruited them, and they helped in the liberation of South America. And the reason most of the countries in South America are independent today is because of the people in Haiti, as Sister Beniswa talked about, who organized with Simon Bolivar. So we as a people have to, first of all, recognize, as Brother from Greensboro said, that we are one people around the earth who have the same problems, and begin to connect and organize with these people and to get the same kind of thinking. I may be Muslim, you may be Christian. I may be Christian, you may be Muslim. But we got to recognize that all of us have the same enemy. No matter what our religion is, it does not matter. You can go down to Mississippi right now and be light-skinned, dark-skinned, or you can be a teasing tan. But if you're in Mississippi, you're going to be looked upon in the same way. So we have to, as Dr. Clark said too, recognize that we're one people, and African people all the way around this world And the only way that we can do this is through organization. And another point I want to make as we begin to close out, and that is, since Benicio, I gave a good example of Haitian Revolution, you talked about Malcolm, you talked about Colombo in South America. Also, I would just like for some of our people who have not seen it, I haven't seen it in a while now, but look at the movie, The Spook Who Sat by the Door. Sam Greenlee's movie, The Spook Who Sat by the Door. And look at it and begin to pick up some ideas and some things that can be done from that movie. And you'll begin to understand what I've been saying, and also Brother Greensboro, and that is to recognize that you can't talk about everything, but we must become doers and not just talkers.
Right. And that's really the point of the program today, was to see just what can be discussed and what cannot be discussed, and to just understand the clarity of the energy that's going on around us right now. I want Brother Timothy, I want him to, I'll let him close us out, kind of thing. We got about
Thanks again, Bill, for inviting me too. I'm still listening.
Appreciate it. Brother Timothy, why don't you close us out in terms of agenda, in terms of strategy, organizing, because we did mention just now Malcolm's approach to doing that in terms of a crisis. So instead of the teddy bears and candles, Malcolm called together a bunch of the brothers who went down to the precinct and asked the police what the heck was going on. Where is that now? Is that still possible as we look around America?
Well, I'm going to say to you that the brother who said he was influenced by the Nation of Islam, he may have said he was in it. I'm not sure if he said that, but I would say this, that he is correct. He's correct that our main objective is schools, hospitals, and businesses. That's one thing. The other thing, the message said, do not carry more than a penknife. But he also said, they shoot as you shoot back. So he said that the battle's in the sky. But Dr. Rogers, I have more than one home. And the home that I live at right now, my neighborhood is gentrified. And when I bought my house, there were 14 empty lots and abandoned housing. And when I was going to purchase the home, the realtor said to me, he said to me, Mr. Hanna, he said, they didn't listen to Jesus, did they? I said, no, they didn't. He said, buy this house because the developer's going to come and they're going to build this area. He was correct. Well, Dr. Rogers, the plague of drugs came in certain parts of Philadelphia and destroyed what we know as a black community. Okay. So when it comes to school, they closed schools to build condos. We don't have any businesses in most black neighborhoods in Philadelphia.
Okay.
When it comes to even the medical centers that a lot of doctors who came at HBCUs and got their medical degrees and PWIs, they don't even have the medical centers in the city.
You got about You got about 4 minutes.
Okay, real quick. A friend of mine who was a professor, he was just in the Dominican Republic. He said most of the resources are owned by Americans, even Jamaica. I've been to Jamaica, so the same thing. My thing is, the unity is one thing. The objective and goal is another thing. Getting together with the goals and the steps to bring that organization back with the unity, like the sister said, with your and Dr. Bridges, with your African mind and your set being focused. The other thing I'm going to say to you, Dr. Rogers, and all these brilliant people that are on this line, is bringing it together and keeping us together and staying focused of the main objective.
Okay.
Now, what can I tell you, sir? All I can say, it starts with us. We're on the phone. We're doing it. We need other people to connect with us to hear it.
Okay. That's what we need. Okay, folks, this is not a one-time conversation. We will be doing this, a second part of this coming up. I appreciate all of you for listening. I understand that there was some interruption on the internet part of this, but it did come back on. I had an engineer who was able to get it back online, so it is there. We're still going to do an archive of what we do have. But we are going to revisit this again. I appreciate all of you for your effort of being here. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Rogers.
Have a wonderful Right Black Week.
Thank you.
We'll talk very soon. Thank you.
you, beloved.
Thank you, sir. Thank
Everybody
you, sir.
Have a good evening.
Same here.
Peace and love.
Peace and love it is.
Love and peace.
Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? They said another brother's dead. They said he's dead, but he can't be buried. They said he's dead, but he can't be buried. Come on, come on, come on, come on. This can't be real. Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? They said they shot him in his head. Shot in the head to save his country. A shot in the head to save his country. Hey, come on, come on, come on, come on. This can't be real. Did you hear what they said? Yeah.